Hello and welcome to today's program at the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is The Economics of Good and Evil with Thomas Sedlacek. And I know you will enjoy this program. Tonight, to introduce the program, I would like to first introduce Richard Pivnica, who is a member of the Board of Governors here at the Commonwealth Club. He is also the Honorary Consul General of Czech Republic and the Chairman of Czech Tech. So please welcome Richard.
I must say I'm delighted to be here, but all those three posts, I don't think I'm qualified to introduce anyone on economics because none of those posts have any economic input. Tomas Sedlacek is a friend of ours, so I may be biased in this introduction. He is the economist for the largest bank in the Czech Republic, CSOB. Recently, the Yale Economic Review cited him as the five brightest minds in economics. So we will see tonight, Tomas. He published the book we're going to hear about, The Economics of Good and Evil, and it was converted into a play, and I would say that must be a risky economic move, Tomas. However, I would have been wrong because there were 100 performances of this play in the Czech Republic, including four sold out at the National Theater and then Bucharest and now London. And then in London, he addressed the Henry Jackson Society at the House of Commons, the Royal Society of Arts, Oxford, Cambridge, then on the way here, the World Bank, and the other usual suspects on the way here, Harvard, Yale Club. So, Thomas, please join us.
I need to switch myself on.
I think I'm on. Okay, good. Thank you very much for those kind words. Thank you very much for being here. And we have about 4 hours to spend together. And let's see how best to divide it. I say we do it 50-50. I speak the first 30 minutes and then you get the rest. You can ask about anything that interests you. You can also ask about things that don't interest you at all, such as economics of good and evil. But I'll try and make you interested in... All right. Okay, that's better. Why is the book called Economics of Good and Evil, and what's interesting, and why should people read it, and what could be a contribution? The title itself is a provocation because economists are not supposed to talk about good and evil. This is what you get, Economics 101. We do not talk about... First rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. First rule of economics is you do not talk about good and evil. In this, we're sort of trying to get back into the Garden of Eden before Adam and Eve did the fruit thing and started talking about good and evil, but before they had no knowledge of good and evil, and this is something that we try to do in economics. I mean, consequently, Milton Friedman said once that in his famous article, Economics as a positive essay on positive economics, there's a famous quote, of course, the argument goes, economists should not have normative judgments, we should only speak of positive things. In other words, we should not be value-laden, we should only describe things as they are, not the way we want them to be. So let me here quote the master himself, and actually one of the introductory sentences in that very famous essay by Milton Friedman is, and he says, I quote, "Economics should be a positive science." Now, is that a normative or positive statement? That's a normative statement. Milton happened to believe, his values happened to be, that economics should be value-free, which is, by the way, a huge value, especially to us economists. And also, you know, he was describing not economics as it is, but as he wanted it to be. And this is fine, but let's not pretend there is no values in economics. What I try to do in the book, in the first part of the book, I look on economics, and I look for, actually, economics in myth, religion, theology, philosophy, belief systems, only to find a lot of that. I was actually expecting to find very little. There is tons. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the oldest epic or story that we have, way older than Bible, for example, the very first protest that we have in the history of mankind, and it had also something to do with the wall. You know, we have Occupy Wall Street. So in Gilgamesh, we had also the first revolt of people had something to do with the wall, because Gilgamesh, the king of Uruk, was forcing his people into slavery, building his wall around this city, and people were complaining to gods, going around with all these signs, and then God punishes Gilgamesh by sending this wild beast called Enkidu. So although I was working on the book for now 10 years, the time of it came, I was lucky in this. So that's the first part of the book, and I will show you a couple of examples how I try to do that. And in the second part of the book, I try to look, in modern economics for belief systems, myths, religion, theology, philosophy of modern economics, again, to find a huge amount of that. So let's start, for example, with this story that we all know, which is in the Old Testament, the story of the Garden of Eden and the original sin. Now, how to read this economically, and I will try to show that it is actually not difficult to read it economically, and in fact, it is impossible to separate the two. When you separate economics from philosophy, ethics especially, or other humanities, it stops making sense. This, I think, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly what we're witnessing today with, for example, the Occupy Wall Street movement. Isn't the complaint there, we don't know what's wrong exactly, but there's something wrong with it, and you fix it. Now, a lot of commentators are very critical about this, and they don't know what they want. But isn't this what we do in our daily lives all the time? My computer doesn't work. I don't know what's wrong with it. Something's wrong with it. You go and fix it. It is not their responsibility to come up with the answers. They are, let's say, customers of the system. It is our responsibility as economists and humanity students. So I think the complaint there is, let's take an example from modern pulp culture, horror genre. What happens when you separate a body from the soul? What do you get? You get a zombie. Very good. So something that was supposed to serve an instrument, like a body is supposed to serve the soul, I hope. My soul is, or whatever, spirit, whatever it is in me, is telling my hands to wiggle around in a very funny manner, and they do. So the body is listening to the impulses of the soul. When you remove the soul from the body, you get a zombie, which is inhuman, looks like a human, but it isn't human. So that's, I think, the complaint of the Wall Street protesters is we've lost the soul. The question here, the debate here, isn't whether economics or markets or capitalism work or not. I think they do very well. The question is whether they work the way we want them to work. And suddenly there you have a normative statement. I mean, you can't really duck it. Does capitalism work the way we want it to work? And there the question is, of course, not absolutely. Many cases, yes. Some cases, no. So, okay, you get a zombie. This, I think, is easy. But you also get a ghost. If you separate the body from the soul, you get two horror elements. One of them is zombie that attacks you. And the other one is a ghost, sort of a psychological superego that blames you. What does a ghost do? Ghost doesn't really attack. Ghosts stare. They have this deadly stare. They scare you. And this, I think, exactly is what happened. If you divide what always was together and what is supposed to be together, and I'll put some arguments to support that thesis, you get ridiculous moral standards or requests of the market. And in this, I think the Tea Party people and the Occupy Wall Street people are similar in what they both overestimate the value of the market. One, blame it for every evil in the world, that human beings are stupid and egoistic. Well, okay, what does that have to do with capitalism? And the others, the Tea Party movement, they overestimate the power of economics because they think that unregulated markets is an answer to every trouble that we have. So they, in this, they could both shake hands. So here, you have a body that's supposed to serve us. It no longer serves us. It does a thing of its own. And superego, too critical, ethical, sort of a request of the economy. Now, we need to put this back together. Now, the whole idea that the economy is a machine is something that needs to be questioned. This is one of the myths that we have in our heads, I think. I have it in my head. I think this is quite common, that the economy is a physics-like machine that works with rules that you do not compromise, you can't debate. And then around it, we cushion it with the government, we cushion it with aid, we cushion it with NGOs, we cushion it with whatever. Now, this, I think, is a wrong understanding of economics, and it can lead to many errors of perception. Now, let's take a look on another genre, which I think gives answers. I mean, there's so many things that you cannot see if you look on one specific scientific field alone. I think there you have a beautiful saying in English that, you know, certain things fall in between the cracks. You can easily make the argument that some of those things that fall in between the cracks of specialization tend to be very important. So let's take a look at, for example, Matrix. The plot in Matrix, like many other science fiction stories, is a machine that was supposed to serve us, the robots, we end up serving it. If you remember, human beings become something like a battery that serves the robot. This, I think, is the feeling that many people express. This in psychology, in Lacanian psychology, is called a partial object, object petit a, something that's supposed to be an instrument, gets a life of its own. Now, just think of the movie AI or any actually science fiction movie. The problem there is these machines get a life of their own and they get out of control. The story of Gollum, you can even see this in most of Milan Kundera's stories, by the way. Isn't there this plot always in almost all of his stories? It's usually a man, usually starts usually a sexual game with a woman because he thinks he can control it, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the narrative, the game controls the player. In other words, from a puppeteer, you become a puppet. Now, this can happen, and it happens also maybe in The Lord of the Rings, for example, okay? How would an economist read that beautiful trilogy? Well, who is the Lord of the trilogy is called The Lord of the Rings, yes? The CEO of the rings, we would say. Well, a proper question is, who is the CEO of the ring? Okay, is he really? Does he control the ring? Does the ring answer to him? The whole trilogy is about him trying to get in control. He looks for it. He seeks the ring, but he can't exactly control it because it's sort of a disjointed ownership. You can even go even further than that and say, well, how is the pecking order really organized? If you destroy the ring, you destroy Saruman. So who owns the ring? Who is the lord of the ring? The ring, exactly. So here you see another example of a partial object. The ring enslaves. The ring has a will of its own, like Gandalf says. And here, of gone, this could be... So why did Aragorn never touch the ring? Why did Gandalf never touch the ring? Why did Galadriel never touch the drink? The ring, sorry. Here, I'm thinking a little bit forward. Don't touch the ring, it's treacherous. It has a will of its own. Yeah, you can even read alcohol like that, you know. It isn't us drinking alcohol. Alcohol embodies itself in us. So ring is in control and it enslaves. So the ownership there is very, very, very complicated. Now, let's have a look at the very first ownership. And here we get back to the Bible. And I can run this in from a Greek point of view, from a Babylonian point of view, and from a Christian point of view, this is what I do in the book. But here, I only want to touch upon a few, sort of cherry-picking from the book. The original sin was always read in sort of a sexual connotation, especially in the medieval times. There must have something sexual happened in the garden. Well, we don't read anything about any sex, unfortunately, in the garden. The only thing we read, that they consumed something that they were not supposed to consume. So, to an economist, the reading here is easy. It was a consumer sin. It actually repeats the word consumed 3 times in one sentence. She saw, consumed, gave the apple to consume to Adam, and Adam also consumed. 3 times the word. So it's really, the economic reading there is much more straightforward than the sexual reading that is unsupported. So, you know, to an economist, I think this makes much more sense. And, you know, they didn't eat it, and this is my second point, they didn't eat it out of hunger. They didn't need to consume it. This is, you know, we have this 13th chamber. That's, you know, the fairy tale about this rich king inviting this poor girl to his castle, and you can do whatever you want to do in all chambers. Only one chamber do not open. She always does open. And again, she doesn't really need to open that chamber. It's not that she doesn't have anywhere to put a vacuum cleaner. We always make the biggest mistakes out of unnecessity. So they consume something that they were not supposed to consume, and that this is the reason why they were thrown out of the garden, the story says. And it is as if God is saying, because what I gave you wasn't enough, nothing will be enough. So Eve gets cursed. I call this a curse of demand. You will want, but you will not get. Your wants will always run away from you. And Adam gets the curse of supply. You will work, but it will not be enough to satisfy her demands. So there you have demand and supply right away in Genesis chapter 4. And it makes perfect sense because you will work in the sweat of your bra. I said bra yesterday, so I mustn't say that. In the sweat of your brow. Sorry, I'm Czech here. I'm European. We don't do English. We only use it to watch movies. And the nature will be against you. You will lose this harmony. We read the same story in the same topic in the story of Prometheus. When these two brothers, Prometheus and his other brother, whose name is really difficult to pronounce, so I won't say it, they are charged with empowering all animals, including human beings. So, you know, to turtles they give the nice little shield, to tigers they give teeth, so that they can protect themselves in the nature. Only, bummer, human beings, when it came to human beings, they already gave everything out. So, you know, human beings don't have anything special. We don't have very strong teeth. We don't have very strong nails. We can't really run. We can't hide. We're usually very pale. And so Prometheus comes up with this idea. Okay, we ran out of gifts. Let's go and give them knowledge. Let's go and give them. It is represented in the arts. It's represented by fire. But it actually says technai. So Prometheus stole technai. This is translated as knowledge, technology, from the gods to human beings. And this, of course, makes everybody very angry. And they send, as a punishment, they send Pandora. Pandora is sort of Eve, also the first woman created in Greek mythology. Only she wasn't created as a help, but as a curse. So here comes Pandora with her curses. One of her curses is also the curse of labor. So what was once pleasant now becomes tedious and toilsome. So here too, knowledge is traded off for harmony. So they lived in harmony before that. They gained knowledge. This is typical of Greeks. The knowledge in Greek terminology is technical, scientific, philosophical. In the Hebrew, it is also knowledge, but it's moral, knowledge of good and evil. And in the to run the whole story, and in the Epic of Gilgamesh, there is also a story how animals become human beings. This Enkidu becomes a human being eventually, and the line goes, he gained reason, and animals ran away from him. So again, this harmony with nature we've lost because of knowledge. And there's a beautiful story actually about this also in the book of Genesis, where the first ownership, again, an economic question where I will try to argue that ethics and economics is inseparable. The first ownership of mankind was what? It was the leaf, right? Which later became skin. Now, again, we read in all textbooks that human beings started dressing because they were cold. Why did Adam and Eve cover themselves? Shame. So here you see that the reason for ownership wasn't, again, necessity, but it was psychologically moral feeling of inferiority, which we tried to cover up by covering literally up our most sensitive and most intimate parts. Now, this is the moment where economy is born, because if you become what I call naturally unnatural, since then we feel much more natural when we are unnatural. This is true psychologically and from other aspects as well. Let's take a very stupid example. This room, again, is warm enough for all of us to sit here naked. In other words, to be natural, the way we were born. Because you don't really see me. You see maybe my face and my palms, but that's it. The rest of it is Hugo Boss. Not really, but... so we feel... But if we'd sit here naked, we would feel very, very unnatural. Because we feel more natural when we are unnatural. In other words, I feel much more Tomáš Sedláček when I am in the skin of Hugo Boss. This is the engine of economics. This is the very reason why we want an external thing, because of some internal disbalance, the book of Genesis tells us. Okay, a third example, and I have 6 minutes, is this beautiful story. Actually, now we are in the middle of a business cycle, yes? The bottoming part. We don't know where exactly, but somewhere here. So it's useful to take a look on the very first, historically very first business cycle in the history of mankind. Now, this is, again, a question for you if you can recall. Good years, bad years. That's right. The story of Joseph. Everybody recalls. I'll just summarize very quickly. Pharaoh has a dream. He dreams about 7 fat cows. Here I always have to be careful not to look on anyone in particular. 7 fat cows and 7 thin cows. And he doesn't know what to make of it, so he calls upon Joseph. And then, you know, I understand you can interpret dreams, so please, what to make of it? And Joseph says, congratulations, Pharaoh. You just had a first ever macroeconomic prediction 14 years ahead of time in a dream. We usually get it wrong 2 years ahead of time. He got it right, the story says, 14 years ahead. In other words, you will have 7 very good years and 7 very bad years. So Pharaoh says, okay, thank you very much. That makes sense, of course. Now, the second question that I have for you, what am I to do with it? Please help me become my Greenspan or somebody else, maybe. So Joseph says, well, because I've read this Lord Keynes, I know exactly what to do with it. In the good years, do not consume everything that grows, but save. Oh, this is an interesting word, by the way, save. I still think it has an entry in Wikipedia. Saving. So that's in the past. Before you bought something, people would go through this very painful sort of a purgatory, consumer purgatory, where in which you saved. Primitive. So, in the good years, do not eat everything that grows, but save 1/5 of it and create grain houses. So that in the bad years, you can invest, this one we know very well, and you will not die of hunger. In other words, translated into economics, in good years, create budget surpluses. Well, by the way, when is the last time when you've heard the word budget and surplus in one sentence? We could even, I don't know if you have this game on associations. So I say budget, and you say deficit, yeah? So that you can run budget deficits in the bad years. In other words, take the energy from the good years and teleport it, so to speak, into the bad years. So what are the lessons from that story? First of all, the first sign of future was revealed in a dream. The question is, why was it revealed to Pharaoh and not to the Hebrews? But that's a different question. Also, the value of information. Egypt enslaved all the nations because of this piece of information that Pharaoh had. So today, what reveals the future of the economy today? Models. Models tell us, it used to be dreams telling us the future, now it's the models telling us the future. Now, they seem polar opposite, right? Very technical, sophisticated models with very boring people and fuzzy, dreamy, poetic dreams. Well, they're not really that far from each other as it seems, because how do you construct a model? You close your eyes. You know, let's imagine that the friction of air doesn't exist. Oh, and suddenly, of course, this is stupid. The friction of air does exist. But it's a very useful abstraction which makes the calculation of the free fall much easier. Okay, so for example, in economics, we have this thing called a rational consumer. Did you ever meet a rational consumer in your life? But on some level of fiction, they exist. Because, I mean, obviously, they're like yetis. Everybody talks about them. Nobody's really seen one, but the world is nicer with yetis than without it. So we have these models that aren't really real in sort of a real sense of it. But they are real on a different level of friction. Good. We agree with everything you say. Could you stop? Firstly. Secondly, the role of economists never was to increase GDP growth. On the contrary, the role of economists is to decrease GDP growth. The role of economists is to decrease the amplitude of a business cycle. In other words, in good years, curb down growth. And I know this sounds, it's not 10 o'clock yet, but it sounds very perverse. So that in bad years, you can increase GDP growth. But you can't do it all the time, which is what we're doing. By the way, if you fast forward the story about the 7 good years and 7 bad years till today, our civilization also had 7 very good years. Bracketed, interestingly, I think this is just a coincidence, but bracketed by 2 very significant events. One was September 11, 2001. This was an interesting year, not just because of the terrorist attacks. This was the last year when you had a budget surplus of the federal budget. This was the budget when Fed started doing very aggressive interest rate dumping sort of philosophy, and the world started growing tremendously. And another interesting event of our generation, it was the collapse of a Lehman Brothers, and if you recall, that also happened in September 2008. So coincidence had it so that we had 7 very strong years bracketed by 2 important events. Now, what did we do with all that magnificent growth? The world has never grown with this speed. The average GDP growth of the whole world was 5% annually. This is crazy. What did we do? Looking at it from the perspective of, from Joseph's perspective. Yeah, exactly. We burned all the wood in summer. And we lent some more and we burned it again in summer because we were too lazy to put on a jacket. So now the winter came and there is no more wood to burn. In other words, that what was precious and was to be used only in bad years, namely deficits, we've used them up in good years instead of creating surpluses to pay down debt. So we've chose speed instead of stability. One last parallel here, and I will exactly 30 minutes, and then we get questions and answers. You know, I think the economy could be well likened to a manic depressive patient. It exaggerates its good moods into manias, and it exaggerates its bad moods into depressions, very severe depressions. Now, I don't know if there is anybody who's does psychiatry or psychology. How do you treat a manic depressive, a patient with a bipolar disorder? You give him stabilizers. Because the thing you have to attack first is the mania. You can't just treat the depressions. You have to treat the whole thing. You have to first, again, decrease the amplitude of a business cycle. So you first have to make sure that when times are good, we won't be doing what we did a couple of years ago. And I will end with this again. Have the story that is understandable to a seven-year-old child. We never thought of it. We've heard the story many times, maybe in our Bible school, Sunday school, sorry. We never thought of connecting it actually with economics, although you see that this is purely macroeconomic fiscal policy sort of a story. Plus, and this is the whole irony of the thing, with more wisdom in it, and this story is 3,000 years old, and again, a seven-year-old can understand, compared to how many 70,000 economists produced a year in America alone, with Harvard and Yale and Berkeley, and failing to actually grasp the very wisdom that is actually very trivial and not so difficult to grasp. In this, we've become a society of, we have a beautiful word, a German word, which we use. It's called Fachidioten. So those would be expert-trained idiots, which I'm afraid we have sometimes become. Everybody understands a little bit of really nothing, and this scientific idea that we can glue it together and that we can talk doesn't really work. My wife's a sociologist, believe me. These two areas do not communicate. Thank you very much. Do you need my thing?
Thank you, Tomas. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Thomas Sedlacek speaking on the economics of good and evil. We are going to turn it over to the audience now. If you'd like to go over to the microphone on my left.
Or come to my jacket. Which one?
Okay. You want me to come up there?
Okay, sure.
Thank you, Thomas, for coming all the way from Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic, I believe.
I come from both. My mother was Slovak. Yes. You said it right.
I hope you didn't have to swim.
No.
Either way. Is there, in your opinion, any assumption? I've taken all the basic economics classes and then some. Is there any assumption of economics that's actually true?
No. And this is the thing, we actually admit it. So here we live in fictions, you know. I don't think the ancients really believed that there is such a thing as the god of the sun. It was a fiction. Like, do we really? So how do we believe Homo economicus, for example, okay, which is a basic model of microeconomy? Do we believe that it actually, is it a fiction or is it real? And we need to, this is a crucial question to ask. So if you say, no, it's real, it really exists, then I would say that we are more blind than the ancients, because they were at least aware of what they believed. And if we say, no, it's a fiction, it's a model, it's as if it's it isn't really real, but it's useful abstraction, it's a useful model, it's like a map, it's not reality. But then we shouldn't draw conclusions about human rationality. So this is what we do in economics. We suppose human being is egoistic and rational. And we run it through a very sophisticated model, and the conclusion is, yeah, bingo, QED, human being is rational and egoistic. This is sort of the trick. Also, I mean, Samuelson, you must have read Samuelson. This is the Bible of economics today. This is what he does, and I respect the guy a lot. But he tediously proves ridiculous technical mathematical proofs that 1 plus 1 equals 2, and he goes on for 3 pages just to make sure that this is no faith, this is very technical. And then he comes to the next level of argument, and the human being is egoistic and governments are bad. And markets always solves everything. How can you say that? You've just spent 10 pages proving that 1 plus 1 is 2, and now you make a leap of, okay, human beings are free, rational, and governments are wrong. How can you, I mean, please show me at least a 5% of rigorousness of that argument, because this is a philosophical question that you can write 20 books, whether human beings are or not. So we solve the problem by assuming it away. You know, and now we don't know if they're rational or not, so let's just suppose they're rational and shut up. And the conclusion is that they are rational. Yeah. So it's a myth. It's a perfect myth. And again, sometimes it's useful, sometimes it's not. But we should be aware that it has nothing to do with reality, and we even admit it often. Yes, please.
What do you think of the work of our Nobel winners, Sargent and Sims?
Well, I don't know whether we want to go down into that technical level. What I appreciate, and you can even see this with the Nobel Prize, it's even there at the level of Nobel Prizes, the economy is kind of softening, and you get, you know, behavioral economists and sociologists or, did I say behavioral economists? Yeah, and psychologists, sorry, that actually get a proper hearing in the economy. So I welcome this. Thank you. Yes, please. The corduroy guy.
So if Pharaoh ignores Joseph's advice and wastes the surplus, and suddenly you're 4 years into deprivation, and Pharaoh comes back to Joseph, what should Joseph tell him?
Perfect. Perfect. This is, by the way, what happened with the children of Israel. This is how they got in the Egyptian slavery in the first place, which then took them 200 years, and that's then tried to get out the book Exodus. It started by them exactly not having enough reserves, so they had to come and beg for food. So that's one answer. The second, I think, a little better answer is, isn't this... Okay. We all, and this is the truth that even media repeat all the time, it's sort of a cliche. What got us into this problem? Overconsumption. This is stating the obvious, everybody kind of agrees. What's going to get out of this? What is going to get us out of the problem is more consumption and more spending. If individuals do not have enough energy to spend, because we believe that spending is the engine of the economy. So we've exhausted. I can't spend anymore, but I'm told to. So what do? I go into debt so that I'm a good citizen. You know, it's the American way. Contribute to society by spending. No matter what you do, as long as you spend. I can't do it anymore, so the government does it in my stead. The government spends instead of the economy so that the economy is kept alive. This is, of course, an irony, a huge irony. The economy does not stand alone. It needs to be supported by this artificial blood flow from the markets. So the question here is, and I don't think we are experiencing a crisis of capitalism per se. We are experiencing a crisis, what I would call crisis of growth capitalism. Because capitalism, I mean, it's the same today like it was 20 years ago. It was not fair. But we've solved the problems of growth. Let's imagine there's three people sitting around the table and we have two beers. The problem is, how do we split these two beers? Do we rotate them? In that case, this beer is no longer mine. How do I split it? Do I get it because I'm younger, or do I get it because I'm richer? Do I get it because I brewed the beer? Do I get it because I'm funnier? What's the rules of redistribution? This is a serious question that we need to ask ourselves. The way we solve this question in the past is that somehow a third beer appeared on the table. This is called growth. Somehow the third beer. So the problem of redistribution is solved because everybody has a beer, so who cares? We do not need to talk about these serious issues because we have been bribed by growth. So our intellect, and this I think we are behind, our intellectual debt to society and to the topic has been bribed by growth because we never needed to talk about it. So here's the question. Is growth a result of capitalism, or is it a conditio sine qua non of capitalism? In other words, does capitalism need growth? And my argument here is no. I believe in capitalism. I don't believe in growth capitalism. It can't grow all the time, every year, every day, every second, every quarter. It's impossible. Since time immemorial, it went up and down in circles. And the same story you can go with fiscal monetary policy. Again, the wisdom of the ages. What was the problem? Well, so low interest rates and cheap money. This is what got us all into the banking problems. You've heard the story 10,000 times. What's the solution? Even cheaper money and even lower interest rate. Only bummer we can't go below zero. I wish we could. Let's give people money for taking loans. Let's have negative interest rate. If you have $100 today, you count 102. You only have to return 100. So, very good question. And, yeah, I was told to be very brief in my answers, which annoys me. Yeah.
Is there any economic perspective that you've come across that values a healthy environment?
So, okay, so this is the problem. And this is maybe if there's one thing that I would like you to take home, and thank you very much, is this. The economy is limping. Why is it limping? Because we have values. Some of those values have a price, and others do not. How can you run accounting of that system without it limping? So, for example, clean air, or family, or love, or poetry, or, I don't know, a tree, a nice view, is a value that we all agree on. This is clear. But it doesn't have a price. And yet we're putting it in an equation, sort of, with other values that do have a price. Microphone, this pulpit, I don't know what, clock, watches. These values, important values, Coke and things like that, they have a price. The nice thing about Coke is it's so egalitarian, by the way. You Americans have invented the most egalitarian drink because the queen cannot have better Coke than a Gastarbeiter. Whereas with wine, you can go fancy yourself for $2,000 a bottle. But with Coke, I mean, there is no archive Coke. Or it's a perfect proletarian, you know, communist dream sort of come true. Take an example, for example. That was redundant. You have beautiful views around your beautiful city. But that is a soft value. It doesn't have a price. Although we all agree it's a value. Now, let's imagine there comes a man and says, okay, I will build a huge advertising sort of a thing, and the structure will cost me $2,000. And as a revenue, I get $7,000 a year, so it's an easy investment. And this makes sense, and this is what we do. Now, what is the mistake there? He didn't put a price in destroying the view, which could... So here his profit is, what, $6,800? Costs minus, I mean, revenue minus costs. So this is clear profit. But he didn't include in the equation the beauty of the view, which could be worth $2 million. And this is why the economy inevitably has to be limping because we are here. And this is, you know, valuing two unequal partners. This you can see, by the way, again, in culture and until today, that hard has a tendency to kill the soft. Kine kills able. Kine in Hebrew means a blacksmith, you know, hard, iron man, literally. Whereas able means a whirlwind, a mist, sort of a fuzzy. And ever since, and you can see this in Matrix, again, Agent Smith, by the way, he's called Agent Smith, same, repetitive, he only wants everyone to look like him, is always trying to kill this guy called Neo, who is new, original, tries to be individual, and what really depresses him is this thought that he's not really original. As you can see, he's being tortured by the architect in the third part. So this is something that we need to be aware of. It must be limping. And there are only two ways out of it. Either we start giving prices to all values that we have, or fuzzy the hard values. In other words, price isn't price. Price doesn't carry all the information you need to. There's more to a value than just a price. And this is the way I would suggest to go. And we can, of course, go into debate. Yes, please. Sorry.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to your discussion of the 2000 decade when the GDP was growing so quickly. One of the underlying factors of that is that productivity was just soaring during that time, output per input of labor and other inputs. And so as we continue to develop more and more technologies and as we continue to push growth, again, as you were saying a minute ago, we're continuing to negate the need for human labor. So where does that lead us long term?
Very good point.
Any thoughts on that?
Yes, many thoughts.
I figured.
It's a very good question. And I would even go further than you go. And I would even argue that half of our growth was artificial. and I will try and make that point. Like a wave, when you have a wave, it takes the water from the surrounding, yeah, and it builds it into the wave. Now, isn't this a good parallel to our growth? We have taken energy from the past in the form of fossil and mineral fuels. We are the first generation, the second generation that can use that. Nobody's been able to. That's actually perfect solar energy, by the way. Coal and everything. It's, you know, solar energy of the past, which only we now can use. No wonder we're growing. This is no surprise. But that resource is running to an end, and we know it. We are aware of it. Generation ago, we were not aware. We thought it's endless. The second source of growth, again, taking water to make growth, is the future. And this is debt. In other words, only if I take a loan of $10,000, only a fool would say that I'm $10,000 richer, yeah? It doesn't, I mean, you're not. It's, you know, in double accounting, you can see it. It would be stupid. I can behave like I'm $10,000 richer. But please mark this. When the government does it, this is exactly how we perceive it. In other words, the government takes a loan that makes a deficit of 3% in that given year. Let's suppose that year it grows by 3%. Everybody's going orgastic. This is not GDP in terms of gross domestic product. This is GDP in terms of gross debt product. Our growth was produced here by debt alone. In other words, in the year 2009, American economy, if it had balanced budget, in other words, if it was playing fair, so to speak, if it wasn't running on tomorrow's energy, the fall of GDP would be minus 23%. Now, the number itself isn't important. What's important is nobody asks the question. Our GDP fall was 7%. Yeah, but you cushioned it with so much debt. If you wouldn't do that, the GDP, until today, we, in fact, are not growing because our deficits are larger than our GDP growth. So, in other words, the statistic of GDP loses sense and any meaning in years where deficits are double or triple the size of growth. I mean, come on, please. This makes no sense. So, and that is another source of growth and if we have time, I will try to show you how interest rate is similar to alcohol, because interest rate makes time travel of energy, of money, possible. And alcohol also makes energy, time travel possible. But I will only come to that if we have time and if you're interested. So that's the second source of growth, which is unfair and which we also run. America cannot go much more into debt. You know, you can be downgraded. Europe cannot no longer go into debt because we have Greece and other countries, thank God. And the third source of growth is maybe geopolitically in terms of the third world countries, which we have exploited. And by the way, here we must be fair. Europe was a much more brutal superpower than America, because we Europeans now tend to say, oh, you know, America, It's such an imperialistic superpower. I say, no, this is not a fair comparison. You must compare like to a like. How did we behave when we could exploit? We did literally exploit. We made slaves. We stole gold. No, nowhere even close to that. But anyway, this source is running out of steam as well. We can't do that anymore. We realize that these guys have lives too. So we have, my argument is, we have had artificial levels of growth, artificial high levels of growth, to which we got addicted. We got addicted to solving all our problems with growth. Isn't that the solution to all the problems in the world, growth? And a point here, which you made, is technology. Yeah, I think we must. And this is—it's actually interesting talking about in the same week that Steve Jobs died. Maybe iPhone 5 will not be any better than iPhone 4. That's a possibility. In other words, let's imagine that 10 years, scientists don't invent any faster Wi-Fi's, any better Bluetooth. They just—I mean, it's just—I don't know. It doesn't. The inspirations run dry. iPhone 5 is going to be pretty much the same like iPhone 4. What then will pull growth? So, in other words, we must ready ourselves for a stationary economy, which, by the way, was the key topic of classical economics. It wasn't growth. They all neglected growth. They said, okay, who cares? We will grow, and then we'll get into the stationary state. Maybe you can connect that with Marx. Marx was one of a classical economist, but this was the same question Smith had, Schumpeter had, Thomas Malthus had. Where will this end? How will the stationary state look like? We keep growing. Who cares? But we keep growing for 80 years. This is a beautiful essay by Keynes. Is the economic prospects of our grandchildren. 3 pages, beautiful, where he argues 80 years ago that in 80 years we will no longer grow, we will no longer elbow each other out because we will all be affluent, this is Galbraith, and we will have no needs anymore. Needs do not want to be satisfied. Needs want to be reproduced. It is not the satisfaction of our wants that we want, but newer and better wants. This is Frank Knight from Chicago. This is the curse of Eve, as we started. We don't want, in other words, did we want more 20 years ago, or do we want more now? Are we more satisfied? No, I want a faster, quicker Bluetooth. I didn't even know what Bluetooth is. I was happy with my, you know, when carbon copy was carbon copy and not CC. Please.
Hi. You talked about how the first Pharaoh anticipated a recession and a boom about 14 years in advance. And you said that most economists can't do that reliably even now.
Yeah.
So you also went on to say that one of the primary roles of economics is to really smoothen down the amplitude, to really dampen down the booms and use that to help the bust. Given that economists have such a hard time with forecasting, how actively do you think the government should be involved in regulating the economy?
So, okay, that's a very good question. The question was, how much should we forecast? And let me, again, take that question and maybe put a little bit more into extreme. Should we be doing forecasting at all? Because here is, again, an extreme example. Let's imagine that suddenly the lights go off in this room, and I am an advisor, and I understand everything because I'm an economist. And I say, okay, people, don't panic. The door is this way. In other words, I predict, I don't know, we live in the world of uncertainty, but I know because I have models or something. The door is that way. And it would be very clever of you to start running towards that because you trust me. And you'd all die, including me. What would you do in a situation where the lights went off and nobody came and stood and told you, I think we're going to grow 6% next year? We would all get down on our knees, on our four, and very slowly, not running, not growing in GDP, very slowly investing our time into finding the door. Isn't this one way how to read the financial crisis? Everybody was so certain it's going to grow 6%. We drew our models with very little variance, extremely. We actually thought that we got rid of uncertainty. This was the whole purpose of credit default swaps, for example. There's an irony there, too. The whole institution of interest rate crumbles here. I would love to talk about interest rate for a little while. Can I talk about interest rate? It's interesting. About interesting rates. So the way it functions is like this. I am a private investor, and let's say you are Greece, and you say, oh, Thomas, I need money. I say, okay, fine. Nobody's forcing me here, okay? This is two individuals. Here's $2 billion, and how do you construct an interest rate? I look at you, how much I trust that you will not go bankrupt. And I put a risk premium. The more likely it is, the higher the interest rate, the higher the risk premium will be. I do that, and immediately as I make the loan, I go to a third party and I secure that. In case Richard goes bankrupt, I'll get my money back from you. That would be nice. This is called credit default swap. So it's all constructed around this attractor, to use chaos mathematics, of bankruptcy. Yeah? But when bankruptcy actually materializes, credit default swaps don't work. This is checks and balances. It's all, I have it double secured. And interest rate doesn't function either. So you could say, oh, it's like a car with a wonderful airbag, and that airbag functions always. It's perfect, and it always will serve you except for when the car crashes. So you construct the whole story again around bankruptcy, but when bankruptcy materializes, the whole story loses point. But what was your question?
So given that economists are so bad at forecasting,
yeah, okay,
do you
predicting,
think government...
yeah. So how I got into it, that we tried to get rid of uncertainty, and wasn't Alan Greenspan credited with, by again, very boring and technical economists with their analysis, with our analysis here, I am one of them, us, that he invented a non-cyclical economy. I don't know if you recall. We all believe that. It's not, you know, I have a good friend. I thought this is a good business idea. We shouldn't be printing jokes. We should just be printing seven-year-old newspapers. I mean, wouldn't that be just fun to read? What we believed 7 years ago, you know. Yeah, so I think so the most dangerous thing is to pretend that there is certainty in obviously uncertain world. And let me, if there's, maybe we have last 8 minutes, so I can take two more questions, I think, and then I'll do the story of interest rate and alcohol.
You've just been talking about one of my favorite topics, which is the
economics.
Illusion of control.
Right, right, exactly.
We have it wherever we turn. And therefore, you have commented on it. If you wish to comment further, I would be happy to hear it. But there's something else. At the Hoover Institution, we have a very interesting scholar named Thomas Sowell. And he made an observation a year or two ago. There are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. Would you give us your observation of that?
Yes. The basic trade-off is, for example, freedom and specialization. We are, and this is again the image of control, we feel the one of the highest values of America and also of Europe, more so I think in America because you have freedom fries, is freedom. We don't have freedom fries. I think French wine will be soon called freedom wine, maybe. Here is the image that you can be independent of a society. Well, the more specialized a society is, the less independent you are. In fact, how many of you sit here in a piece of cloth that you made yourself? Somebody, now, forget about money for a while. Somebody gave you that clothes. Do you know his name? Do you care? No, of course not. But you consider it your own. How many of you can find sources of fresh water? I mean, drinkable water. How many of you can hunt, I suppose, here? How many of you can, you know, I love beer, but I don't know how to make it. I'm reliable here. I'm reliable on 99.9% of my needs on somebody else. While I'm paid for telling, this is what I tell to my son, it's always difficult to explain to kids what it is exactly that we're doing, especially when we're economists. So I say that I tell fairy tales for adults. So. We like talking. We've been talking here for the last hour. And we like making stories. And if it has numbers, that's very nice. But just because it has numbers in it doesn't mean that it's a better story than a parable. So there is a basic trade-off here is... in society, and this is exactly in what we have to be thinking, yeah. So, yes, please. So that's the last question. Anybody else has a burning question I can maybe take? This is the last one, okay.
To me, the story of Joseph sounds like that of a planned economy like China or Soviet Union.
And so why would it sound
like you have a pharaoh, it's not really a democracy.
Oh, okay, all right, okay.
And it's a planned economy. He's planning 14 years, and he's doing other stuff based on that. So do you see instances of socialism in history? And
no, well, I wouldn't read that at all. We make fiscal plans here, too, in America, I think. Mm-hmm. And that has nothing to do with communism. Just because you're running a budget surplus or budget deficit doesn't mean it must be a planned economy. In fact, I wouldn't go as far as to say that Egypt was a planned economy. It was, of course, not what we would call market democracy the way we have it today, mm-hmm. but it wouldn't be a planned economy. And you don't need a plan. Even here you go and you promise our budget will be deficit by, I don't know, 6% GDP. That's a plan that you try to stick to. But
And it's a low-growth socialist economy. Generally, most planned economies don't grow as fast, and they don't heat up that much. They're kind of low-growth economies.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, I was born in communism. I hate that system the most. And here I am an advocate of capitalism. Capitalism is not in crisis. It's the crisis of growth capitalism. And I believe more capitalism than just for a producer of growth. It is better than just a producer of growth. Capitalism is a higher value than making everybody richer by 5% in average in purchasing power parity a year. It's a more precious system than just making us rich. If communism grew 5% every year, would it fall down? I hope so, but this is the question why I ask, is it a condition, conditio sine qua non, or is it a result? I think growth is a result of capitalism, not a conditio sine qua non, a condition without which it doesn't stand. We, I think, tend to believe that growth is something that capitalism needs to operate. I argue, it isn't. It absolutely is not. Okay, one last, really last question, and then I want to do the alcohol story.
I'm looking forward so much to the interest rates and alcohol segment. But a very quick question. It has something to do with entering a period of stationary economics.
Exactly.
And it's a simple question. You can answer it and answer that question at the same time. The Roman Empire existed in a steady state for centuries. Was that considered a capitalist society?
No. Well, it depends what form of capitalism and what do you consider capitalism. Yeah, okay. No, I wouldn't call it capitalist, although, of course, it had capitalist. It really here depends on that's a huge debate, a beautiful debate. Okay, good. I will promise. Yeah, yeah. No, this is exactly part of my book. I call it Shabbat Economics. I mean, this is, I think, of all the Ten Commandments that we can actually count, this is the commandment that we breach the most, is the Shabbat. And, you know, these ancient guys who were 100 times poorer could afford for the economy to rest once in 49 years. And this, I mean, and this is another way how to read the crisis. The human beings are tired. The machines are tired. The nature is tired of all that growth we've had. Relax, for crying out loud. We take it as a tragedy. And of course, people losing jobs, that's a tragedy. But why does a decrease in demand have to reflect in unemployment? Let's imagine that we have 10% decrease in demand. So you can either lay 10% of your workforce off, or you can do something else. You can decrease everybody's workload by 10%. In other words, sorry, I decrease your payment, I mean your wage by 10%, but you get to go home on Thursday afternoon. Yeah, and that's the problem. Exactly. And so you can see that you could only change the system a little bit. It doesn't really need a revolution. It would just allow some small little incentives for the business person not to lay people off, but to say, okay, relax, Thursday afternoon, go bike, spend time with your family, relax, have a Shabbat. So I don't think we have the time for the alcohol interest rate story. We can do it maybe later with...
No, we will. So, unfortunately, we have reached very near the end of our program. We do have time for a very quick response to the alcohol question. I would like to let our audience listening at home know this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight is Thomas Sedlacek speaking on the economics of good and evil. So we will have a quick wrap-up from Tomas. Very quick, please. And then I'll close the program with a formal closing. We will be selling books afterwards outside. Alyssa Elegant, who is our membership specialist, is there at the door. If you would like to become a member tonight, that's a number of great opportunities here. But I do want to hear about the alcohol.
Okay. It's one way how to cheat on time, yeah? Very quickly. Since time immemorial, all the ancient wizards and prophets and philosophers warned us against the use of interest rate. Aristotle, all the way to Thomas Aquinas, Holy Quran, Vedas, Bible, name it. Everybody said, we don't know why exactly, but there's something treacherous. Don't do it. Don't use it. We have made interest rate a founding block of our society, of our culture. We can't live, our economy is, or society is unimaginable without interest rate. Now, why is interest rate bad? Or dangerous? Not bad, sorry. Dangerous. And in this, interest rate makes time travel of money possible. It looks like I'm borrowing money from the bank or from a friend. What really is happening, I'm just vacuum cleaning my future consumption from the future, and I'm doing it now. In other words, I will lack that energy, but I can now buy a Rolls Royce. So interest rate, without interest rate, time could not travel, money could not travel in time. It's like beam me up, Scotty, sort of a thing. Now, why is this similar to alcohol, and why is it dangerous? Alcohol also makes time travel of energy possible. Over short distances, and okay, so on a Friday evening, when you are dancing in the bar, 3 o'clock in the morning, an amazing source of energy, you know, talking to people that you would never have the guts to talk to, in my case, that's girls. And what's more interesting is they talk back, and they think, it looks like they're enjoying talking to me back. The mistake here would be to say that, oh, it's because of alcohol that I'm having all this excess energy. No. The only thing alcohol does is time travels your Saturday morning energy into Friday evening. But the energy of the weekend is constant, so to speak. And this is exactly what interest rate does. And it's okay to get drunk on a Friday evening if you know that there's nothing important happening on Saturday. It's not clever to get drunk on Sunday evening when you have something important happening on Monday. And this is yet another way how to read the crisis. This is the way I kind of like reading the crisis. The book is full of these examples. We have landed with a very bad hangover on a Monday morning. That's the problem with interest rate.
Thank you, Tomas Sedlicek. Our program tonight, The Economics of Good and Evil. And with that, I would like to close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.